From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, psychics and the other side. Here's what's happening. The House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a $484 billion relief package to rescue small businesses, help hospitals, and to expand testing, sending the fourth bipartisan coronavirus bill to President Trump's desk. The legislation will deliver a $310 billion infusion to the Paycheck Protection Program, a forgivable loan program that ran out of money last week amid skyrocketing demand from hurting small businesses. The Senate passed the legislation a few days ago by voice vote. One of the president's economic advisors has admittedly come up with a crazy idea for how to reopen the country amid the corona pandemic. He wants all of us to wear space outfits. His name's Stephen Moore. Not going to happen. I wish they'd spend some time doing something significant, huh? A first human trial in Europe of a coronavirus vaccine has begun in Oxford. Two volunteers were injected, the first of more than 800 people recruited for the study. Half will receive the COVID-19 vaccine, the other half a control vaccine which protects against meningitis, but not coronavirus. The design of the trial means volunteers will not know which vaccine they are getting, though the doctors will. Closely watched Gilead Sciences company, their experimental antiviral drug apparently failed to help patients with severe COVID-19 in a clinical trial conducted in China. But the drug maker said the study's results were inconclusive because it was terminated early. A stunning 26.5 million Americans have sought unemployment benefits since March, confirming that all jobs gained during the longest employment boom in U.S. history have been wiped out as the coronavirus savages still the economy. Christian Wild from myheartbook.com and noted author is with us. And I asked Christian to come up with his weekly report on this coronavirus, and then we'll ask him a few questions after that. Christian, what do you have for us?
Well, George, if some bad actor sent us this virus to destroy us, then they don't know much about Americans and what we're all about. Can you think of a time since World War II when we have been more drawn closer as a nation or the world community in fighting a common enemy? To the first responders, families, and friends out there who gave their lives, I want to just say that the book of John, where Jesus said, "No greater love hath anyone that they give up their life for a friend," and that's what they have done. Now, politics have taken a back seat for a while, George, and it's been refreshing. And 21 companies are scrambling to get fast-track FDA approvals to begin drug and vaccine trials, which would be a year and a half, 2 years, or maybe more away. But how will that help the millions affected and dying today? What can help you and I and Coast to Coast listeners in protecting ourselves and families as the country is about to go back to work and the virus is still lurking out there? Well, maybe this is a good time to be involved more in our own health care, following the advice of some of the most respected experts who tell us repeatedly that maintaining a robust and viable immune system is our best chance to defend against this coronavirus. There's been a whole lot of attention, George, as you know, paid to a 1955 approved drug called hydroxychloroquine that has shown a lot of promise, but the information has been contradictory.
It's unbelievable. You know, we're getting reports that studies say it doesn't work, then we're getting reports that say it does. You don't know who to believe, Christian.
I don't know. We're going to have to just stand by and watch. But here's an example, George. A small veteran study found it's unreliable as compared to a French study that was presented to the Premier of France, claiming a 92% recovery rate among 1,115 COVID patients. So, like you say, let's just get a good seat and watch it. But I do want to share a quick story with you.
Okay.
Dr. Mark Siegel is the go-to medical expert on Fox. And he shared a story of a 90-year-old man who had no chance of surviving the virus. His doctor decided to give him hydroxychloroquine and a Z-Pak, and he recovered and returned home. And he went on to say, that 90-year-old man is my father.
Well, that's a great story. Of course, you don't know if it was the Z-Pak or the Hydro. You just don't know.
You
Christian,
don't know.
But several years ago, I turned you loose to investigate turmeric because
sure
I had seen a story that said it was a great immune booster. And, of course, you went and studied it and came back with a special formula. People can find it at myheartbook.com. But have you found turmeric being used at all in any of these cases?
Oh, yes. I purposely, because I'm involved with turmeric, I've taken a back seat. I don't know if that's been fair to the spice, but I can continually hear reports. Matter of fact, I was looking at something in India when they wanted to find out why there were fewer cases of the coronavirus in India.
Mm-hmm.
They said one thing is the hot weather, but the other thing was turmeric.
It's got the curcumin in there, and it fights.
An antiviral. We talk about it, George, as an antifungal, antibacterial, anti-cancer, but it's also antiviral.
Well, in my regimen, Christian, it's included every day. Christian's website, myheartbook.com, linked up to our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Lots of reports about UFO activity this week. Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hi, Peter.
Good evening, George. And you're right. There have been a lot of reports. I've got about 1,300 that have to be proofread before I
wow.
can post them this weekend. Most of them about the satellites that are passing over.
Elon Musk satellites, yeah. We got a lot of calls on that last Friday.
Yeah, I'll bet. I have four reports I'd like to share. The first one I had prepared last week, and I, to the best of my recollection, I don't think I was able to squeeze it in, but I preface with the gentleman's credentials as an observer, half a century as a commercial pilot, and pushing 20,000 hours as pilot in command. So he's a very, no doubt, an excellent witness. From Gig Harbor, he reports that last Friday, the 17th of April, at about 1,100 hours, just before noon, he saw a very peculiar object almost hovering over the Olympic Peninsula to the west. He watched it for about 10 minutes as it drifted to the east. Probably not a UFO, George, but I cite it because there were no other reports from the Olympic Peninsula on the day of the event and no other reports to the east of there or during the subsequent week, which is very unusual. Have no idea what that object was, but also no notice to airmen, NOTAMs, were issued. A very peculiar situation, and I mention it to alert the Coast audience to its existence. We may see it again. The next report comes from Sunday morning, the 19th of April, Phoenix. A young woman describes seeing a very peculiar object. She estimates that it was 75 feet in diameter, a disc shape with a transparent glass bottom to it with a flashing red light. Very interesting report, and her neighbor saw it at the same time she saw it. So we're hoping to get a second report, and we'll have those posted over the weekend. Last two reports, George, are a follow-on to something I mentioned on April 9th during my presentation, my update on that date. I mentioned a Coast Guard, former Coast Guard employee or serviceman who saw a V-shaped phalanx of nine yellow lights for about 5 or 6 seconds as they streaked over his head. I mention that as a preface to the next two reports I have. The first one comes from Ottawa, Canada this morning, 1:15 a.m. A gentleman saw a wedge-shaped craft consisting of five yellowish lights. They were flying from east to west, went right over his head. He saw them for only about 10 seconds, I think he says. And he no noted that they were maneuvering relative to one another, as in the case of the Coast Guard gentleman sighting who had been in the Coast Guard in Daytona Beach. Last report I'd like to share comes from the Philippines. Three people this morning were standing outside looking for the Lyrid meteors, and they became aware of a boomerang-shaped object, no lights on it. It appeared to be embedding or concealing itself in a cloud and went from east to west over their heads, and they all agreed it was something very peculiar. So it all goes to show, George, just because a person is sheltered down doesn't mean that he or she can't be looking up.
That's so true. That's Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, Daniel Ustilin joins us again, the investigative journalist, as we talk about more about the Bilderberg Group. What are they up to? And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Daniel Ustilin back with us, a Soviet-born writer, investigative journalist, public speaker, and film producer. His first book was called The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, became an international mega bestseller, and that was back about 15 years ago, and he's been nominated for Nobel Peace Prize 2015 for his relentless pursuit of the truth. Back in December of 2015, between 2012 and 14 as well, he has been just working his tail off. Daniel presented and directed the highest-rated Spanish-language TV show in the world and also has a movie called Bilderberg, the Movie. Daniel, welcome back. Tense times these days, huh?
George, it's wonderful to be on your show. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Are you hunkered down wherever you may be? You're in Mexico right now.
I am in Mexico, and I'm not hunkered down. I'm on the beach. Not right now. It's nighttime, but I'm enjoying the beach in Mexico.
Does Mexico have any kind of lockdown at all?
They do have. It's a kind of a very lax Mexican-style lockdown. So basically, you can do whatever you want as long as you don't come too close to people. But as most tourists, as in Canadian, American, and European, are gone a long time ago. There are very few people on the beach, so the maintaining your distance, which is what 6 feet, is not very much a problem.
Daniel, tell us the Bilderberg involvement in the possibility of this coronavirus, if anything. Do you think there's any tie-in?
I have no idea at all. What I can tell you is, again, when we're looking at all these structures, such as the Bilderberg is a trilateral commission, Council on Foreign Relations, you have to understand that they all came out of this post-World War II structures. Remember that on the 25th of March, George, 2020, about a month ago, marked the 63rd anniversary of the Treaty of Rome, which is one of the most important treaties in a long historical trend of European integration. The treaty led to the creation of a single market on the 1st of January, 1958, between France, West Germany, Italy, and the Benelux, for the establishment of the European Economic Community, overseen by the European Commission, which is an executive governmental body operating autonomously from the participating states. So the signing of this treaty didn't come about overnight, but concluded a heavily debated process since the end of World War II, which ended in 1945, between these supranationalists who wanted to create an executive governmental body above all of the nation states, and intergovernmentalists who favored multinational relations. So these debates eventually helped tip the scale in favor of supranational Europe, and that supranational Europe globally since the end of World War II has been represented by the liberal banking financiers, and today is basically your parasitical elite based on Wall Street, based on money creators out of thin air, et cetera, et cetera. And I have no doubts at all. So one of their intents to keep the game going, or I should say, turn the table and start again via chaos.
Let's talk a little bit about what the coronavirus is doing, though. People aren't going out. They've been quarantined. They've been locked down. The price of oil, Daniel, is plummeting. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, that's a very good question. The fall of American WTI oil to negative value, I think, does need an explanation. People are saying, how can oil be negative? Well, first of all, this price is not for oil, but for futures. That's an important differentiation or distinction. And they mean only one thing, that today's production is such that there's no oil. So due to coronavirus, demand fell sharply, obviously. But production did not fall, George. And at the same time, it's difficult and scary to cut production. Why is it scary? Because loans have been taken out against the production projections, loans which must be repaid sometime today, tomorrow, or in the future, especially among shale producers who must continuously drill new wells to maintain the total volume, since their capitalization and creditworthiness in particular depends on it. And in order to drill, they need loans. So as a result, the current negative oil prices are simply the cost of the lack of capacities to store the oil. But for vertically integrated companies, there's no such problem at all, because they deliver to their own plants that produce gasoline, produce oil, produce plastic, and yes, they can and may suffer a little from, you know, today's, yesterday's, this week's storm on the stock exchange, but still the technological complex is not going anywhere. Who will be left standing holding the bag? Those who played up the hype and also suffered as well. So in reality, the price of Brent oil in Western Europe today is higher than it was, for example, a couple of weeks ago at a minimum of about $25 per barrel. That is, there's no hysteria there, and therefore the result of today's prices will be a completely natural process. Production will fall significantly in a couple of months. In particular, the entire shale adventure will be shut down. I want to focus on two points of principle. The first one is that the mechanism of oil pricing created by transnational parasitical banks is so divorced from the real industry and real demand for oil products that it's a purely internal, that is, financial mechanisms. It entered into a collapse. And the main victims will be not even small oil and processing companies, but banks, since their magic making money out of nothing is a thing of the past, as is their overreaching influence, given that they cannot maintain stability in such vital markets as the oil market. As some power broker somewhere not too long ago said, the dollar in the world is needed so that the Saudis can sell oil to China. Or for simplicity, petrodollar rules the world. So this world, like petrodollar, is over. It is dead. And if it is over, if the capitalization of oil companies returns to normal figures related to profit, to production, and to reserves, then not oil companies, but banks will lose. Remember, it is the transnational banks which were the main beneficiaries of the process of increasing capitalization. And the second point I wanted to bring out is no less important than the first. The current situation shows that there can no longer be a single pricing in Western Europe and the United States. That is, prices will begin to be determined in regional markets. In particular, this refers to the markets controlled by China, and it is understandable why. I think China is ready to accept excess oil for quite an acceptable surcharge from the United States. It's not entirely clear whether the United States will agree to this deal. And if they don't agree, then the United States will have to limit its influence on the market with all the consequences. And finally, what this means is that the petrodollar model has come to an end. And if there is no petrodollar, there's no need for a single dollar system. Oil will start to cost differently in regional markets. In other words, the mechanism, George, that arose in 1944 in Western world at the Bretton Woods Conference and which spread to the whole world in 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the socialist bloc, no longer works, which means that the whole concept of nation states, of countries, a Westphalia Agreement, all constitutions, our borders, our own currencies, et cetera, is a thing of the past. What we're seeing right now, we've gone from globalization to regionalization of economies. And yes, oil is important. What we're seeing right now is not an attack on the dollar, on the oil, but the attack on the dollar. And the next step is, needless to say, as I said earlier, regionalization of global economy.
And Daniel, it seems like everything's pointed towards China these days, and we seem to have forgotten about Russia and, of course, the conflicts we've had with them as well. Something strange here. Do you feel it too?
Well, basically, you know, Russia, which was the boogeyman in 2016, 2017, 2018, even in 2019, well, now that boogeyman is China. What people don't seem to understand is how a dynamic, and I do want to explain because it's a good question.
All right, hold on for a second, Daniel. We'll have you finish the question when we come right back as we're at the bottom of the hour. Daniel Estulin, our special guest here, will take calls with him this hour as well. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're with Daniel Estulin. And Daniel, we're talking about China and where they fit into all of this, because they seem to be the new bad people on the block.
They seem to be the new bad people. What most people don't understand is that the United States and China are not two models or two planets or two completely different models. In fact, China and the United States are heads and tails of the same coin. Remember in the last segment, we talked about oil, we talked about the end of the Bretton Woods model. So how does this Bretton Woods model work? The United States prints money, and this money is legalized through multinational banks. Further, with this money, companies are built in China and other countries. Then these companies sell cheap stuff to the United States of America, and the same financial corporations offer cheap credits to American citizens to buy these goods. Everything is wonderful, but there is one problem. America doesn't make the money, but rather transnational corporations. And since these corporations are usually based in the United States, because that's where the money is, and they lend money to American citizens, there's this wonderful feeling that everything is great. But this mechanism, especially its financial aspect, it stopped working after the 2008 crisis. And if we look at the economic growth over the past 12 years, it has been at the expense of faster growth of debt. That is, there was no real growth. In fact, if you subtract from the equation, George, all the money printed in America since Reaganomics beginning in 1981, the actual growth in the United States over the past 40 years is exactly 0%.
Wow.
So the result was this. In the financial sector, the United States ceased to receive income since international corporations stopped investing. In other words, it stopped being profitable. But at the same time, China continued to receive income from trade. That is, there used to be parity, but in different areas. The United States, for example, had a surplus in financial sector in China in trade. And now it has turned out that China has a surplus in trade while the United States does not. And in this situation, Trump began to change the model. He said, let's return production to the United States, and et cetera, make America great again, and that you have your red hat and, you know, Bob's your uncle. However, he also said that the main enemy of American people is international financial corporations. In other words, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, the liberal banking, financial cartel. Now, if you look at the U.S.-China deal, the surplus of foreign trade balance with the United States is $500 billion in favor of China. That's a lot of money. So America's goal is the reindustrialization of the United States. Now, how could China respond to this? The situation there is also fairly awful. Yes, China's annual foreign trade surplus has reached nearly $1 trillion. That's a lot of money. It would seem that everything was fine, but the Chinese balance of payment has always been negative. Now, what does it mean? The Chinese annually print in yuan, so its currency, an equivalent of $4 trillion U.S., while China's GDP, gross domestic product, is $16 trillion. America's is more or less the same, 14.5, 15.5, close to 16. The rest, although they say it's 16, 17, it's pure fiction. So it turns out that the Chinese print 25% of GDP, they just simply print a fourth of all the growth, you know, with the annual growth of 6%. So the question is, what will happen if they take away the opportunity to withdraw this excess mass, which is $500 billion that they generate in trade with the surplus, not for the United States, from circulation through the dollars? It means that there will be an inflation of 25%, which means initially there will be a decline in the difference between monetary emission and GDP growth. That is 19% in the first year. So the Chinese leadership is categorically not happy with this prospect. And I'm inclined to believe, George, that it has arranged a kind of an asymmetrical response. Its logic is very simple. The Chinese essentially are saying, okay, so the whole world economy lives on China's spare parts. And now we will arrange, as it were, we have quarantine, and let's see what happens to your economy when nothing goes anywhere from China. Therefore, be so kind of as buy our products or try to quickly restore your own production. And I can assure you that you will need at least 2 or 3 and maybe even 4 years minimum to do that. And given the overheating of the stock markets, there's simply no time. And I think that the financial liberal globalist cartel slash deep state has taken up the Chinese position in this sense, which is why, as far as I am concerned, again, from a conceptual intelligence point of view, because I'm a doctor of conceptual intelligence, which means we create models that define the future. I think the coronavirus thing is a combination of the deep state globalists and China working together. And the logic here is simple and clear. If the American economy collapses, the people behind Trump, they will lose, Trump will lose, and another president will be elected, maybe Biden or maybe whoever, anyone but Trump, in 2020. There are no documents to prove what I'm saying. This is a hypothesis, but it makes perfect sense, especially if we look at the overall picture of global systemic collapse. Because, again, what we're seeing right now in 2008, it was, they call it the subprime crisis or the Lehman Brothers collapse. It really wasn't that at all. It was the initial step in what we're seeing right now, the meltdown of a systemic crisis, systemic proportions, which means the entire edifice of a global economic model is about to collapse. And you know what? The scary part is, for the first time in very, 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 very long time, we have no model to replace this collapsing model.
Exactly. And I'll tell you what else is strange, Daniel. A couple things. One, where this coronavirus occurred, which was in Wuhan, China, the Chinese, by the way, are now trying to accuse us through the U.S. Army of developing this and planting it in Wuhan. That's another story. But there was a viral lab in Wuhan that we apparently gave $3.7 million to in a grant to work on coronaviruses years ago. And then here's the weird part. 2010, the Rockefeller Foundation predicted a pandemic in 2012. Well, they were 8 years too early. Bill Gates in 2017 talked about a pandemic. Fauci, the infectious disease guy who's with President Trump all the time, predicted in 2017 that there'd be a pandemic with this administration. Don't you find all those weird?
I do. I liked what you said. You said Fauci, the infectious disease, and then you continued that myself. That's kind of appropriate. Anyway, let's leave it at that. What we're seeing right now, yes, I do know the report, the Rockefeller Foundation, which is a known an NGO, that was 2010. They talked exactly the scenario. It's a carbon copy of what's happening right now. They predicted it for 2012. February 2012 was supposed to start, supposed to last 3 years. You're supposed to have 7.5 million dead. And this is a SARS slash coronavirus type of a global pandemic. What we're really seeing, George, right now, globally, if you look at it conceptually, is a change from one techno paradigm to another. There are lots of things about this coronavirus thing, and I'm not going to go into the molecular, because I'm not a virologist. I'm not a doctor. I'm a doctor of conceptual intelligence, which is different. What we have to understand is the fourth techno paradigm, which was industrial economy, was replaced with post-industrial economy, which is financial technologies, service industries, IT, entertainment, telecommunications, etc. And basically, you have the industrialists were replaced by lawyers and managers and bankers and the financiers, the white collar. They were the in people in the 1980s and 1990s. They were driving fancy cars and had the best-looking women. And which is, you know, the fifth paradigm was luxury items, services, expensive cell phones, et cetera, et cetera. You know, massification of tourism, all of that is now gone. The next techno paradigm is the sixth, which is trans-industrial economy. What does it mean? It means robotics. It means additive technologies, which is like 3D printers, for example, artificial intelligence, nanobuying for cognitive, transhumanism, posthumanism. So what we're seeing is that one of the key elements of the sixth techno paradigm is that humans are becoming obsolete, and the global elite, they have a problem. And the problem is, what do they do with 90% of global population that are simply no longer necessary? They were necessary in the financial economies and the service economy, which is the post-industrial, but they're absolutely unnecessary in the trans-industrial sixth paradigm. And the problem is, what do you do with 7 billion people on the planet Earth? Yes, one of the things that they're looking at is universal income as a kind of a stopgap until they decide whether to kill us or do something with us. Because, again, the problem is, when you have robots, when you have artificial intelligence, you don't need people to do most jobs. And also, if you kind of look throughout history, okay, you can't solve economic problems without first solving social problems. You can't solve political problems without solving economic problems. And you can't solve economic problems without solving social problems. So in this world of post-technology, post-industry 3.0, we're looking at a change in the governing model, a model or change leap to a new paradigm. And so we have never, ever, ever in the history of mankind, George, changed a model of governance without global conflict. And the problem is, whether it's in the past you had a world war or some kind of a regional conflict, today you have wars or conflicts between governments, corporation against government, corporation against corporation, dominant cultures against other cultures. You have legislative power against executive versus judiciary. You have the elite versus the people. You have locals versus the immigrants. In the near future, you have humans versus transhumans versus post-humans versus men machines versus cyborgs. You have culture one against culture two. As, for example, you know, the refugees from the third world entering Europe in hordes and droves. So we have this fight of cultures. Any of these conflicts can lead to war, but all of these put together, not even a war can solve. The problem, nobody has a conceptual vision of the world post-crisis, and this is where we are right now. We're trying to figure out what this world is going to be, but until we understand conceptually where we are going, we can never define a model for the world that is about to happen to us. Because, again, all these people, I do want to say this, people are saying that, you know, this is going to get back to the way it was a couple of, you know, months from now. I see economists on television, politicians, it's their job to lie. I understand this. But if people think, and I think this is what, you know, we need to do, we need to tell people the truth. If we think we still have a chance to return to the way it was 3 months ago, in other words, the world of globalization, no. This world is dead, dead as a doorknob. Jeez. Globalization really died on the September 11th. It received its death knells in Libya in 2011, and was liquidated in 2014 in Crimea. It's not coming back. We need to define a new model, and most importantly, we need to understand what it is that we as people do, as humans, that's better than robots, because if we don't, we will become obsolete.
Daniel, assuming this was an accident in a laboratory, but an accident released on us, are there globalists that still are trying to profit from this, are still trying to take advantage of this, and love what's happening right now?
Absolutely. Again, if you kind of look at what really happened, you know, often when I explain to people global situation, I explain to people that one of the key elements in what we're seeing today is the fact that there's some people say $2.5 quadrillion debt, others say four. It doesn't matter what it is. A quadrillion is 15 zeros. No matter what you do, you can't write this amount of money off or print this money off without some kind of a global force majeure event, which means any kind of a natural event that, you know, basically will wipe off all the debts and all the responsibilities. And you could say it's not us, it's a force of nature. That could be some kind of a, you know, meteorite, ETs coming from outer space to say hello to us, Godzilla coming, you know, appearing out of the bottom of the sea. It could be a thermonuclear war, great way to write off debt, to write off debts and responsibilities. And they tried, the globalists, they tried that tack. Remember, on the 3rd of January 2020, they killed Soleimani, okay? And the Middle East is a great place to do this. You have the Russians, the Chinese, you have, it's a melting pot of power. The Americans are there, the Israelis, the Turks, everyone is there. And, you know, and those who killed Soleimani really wanted this global thermonuclear war to start because it solves a lot of problems. First of all, it kills off 4 or 5 billion people, which means that you can reorganize the economy on a much smaller scale. Second of all, you don't have to worry about what to do about all these 7 billion useless eaters, as the Rockefellers and Kissingers call us. And also, again, via force majeure, you write off all these debts and responsibilities. But again, we saw what happened. Nothing happened because no one wanted a thermonuclear war with all its consequences. What's the alternative? The alternative is some kind of a coronavirus as the Rockefeller.
Exactly. And you still keep your infrastructure. You don't lose your buildings. Daniel, we're at the top of the hour. We'll come back and take full phone calls with you next hour on Coast to Coast. Those of you on hold, just hang. We'll get right to you. Daniel Estulin with us. One of his books, of course, is called The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. He's got a movie out called Bilderberg, the movie as well. Back with your calls and your comments on Coast to Coast AM.